Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the PW Torch Livecast. I am Wade Keller, editor and publisher of the Pro Wrestling Torch Weekly Newsletter, PWTorch.com, MMATorch.com, and now the revamped relaunch, PWPodcasts.com. It is Thursday, May 4th, 2017, and we appreciate you joining us here for Interview Thursday. We have a special best of interview from the vault from just over 5 years ago, from March 9th, 2012, just over 5 years ago, with ex-WWE creative team member Seth Mates, who takes us back, and this is a remarkable interview. I love this interview. Going back to the early 2000s, just after the Attitude Era, behind the scenes on Hulk Hogan's return, the XFL, and the rise of John Cena, the emergence of John Cena, and the power broker games of Triple H. Just a fascinating interview. It is evergreen, as they say. It is a timeless interview with Seth. And many of you were not listening to the show 5 years ago. And so welcome. And those of you who were, I think it's worth another listen. So this is WWE creative team member Seth Mates. This interview was well over 2 hours. We're giving you 95 minutes of it here on the live cast today. I'm going to go ahead and put up the rest of it as a VIP after show bonus. This is good stuff. So check it out. If you are not a VIP member and want to gain access to ad-free versions of the live cast, plus over a dozen VIP exclusive podcasts per week, it's around 50 per month, along with access to nearly 30 years of our archives of audio and newsletters, and ad-free access to our website, a special VIP ad-free website, go to pwtorch.com/govip. By the way, thanks to Pat McNeil and Jim Valley for hosting and co-hosting the midweek flagship yesterday. I was able to listen to that during my travels. I had some good callers, some really good conversation with Jim Valley live in Las Vegas at Cauliflower Alley at the convention, and some good calls, some good emails, and just some good conversation with Pat and Jim. So if you didn't check that out yet, some fun conversation about the Vince McMahon biopic and a wide range of topics from WWE to Japan to ROH and more. Check that out. That's yesterday's live cast. And then tonight, right after Impact Wrestling, it is Mike McMahon and Andrew Sochak with the post-Impact edition of the PW Torch live cast, the second edition of the live cast on Thursdays. They'll be on there live tonight. If you're an Impact Wrestling fan or viewer or both, check it out live right after Impact goes off the air on Pop TV tonight. And then tomorrow, Bruce Mitchell and Rich Fan take over the airwaves, and that is the primetime Friday edition of the show, 7 Eastern. So if you normally have to listen to the show on delay, on demand, because you're not available late at night or during the midday when the rest of the shows air, Friday primetime with Bruce and Travis is with Bruce and Rich Fan is a good opportunity to call the show and participate or just listen live as it airs. And that, of course, is always available at pwtorchlivecast.com. So we'll go to our first break, and after this message, we will have that Seth Mates interview from March 9th, 2012, just over 5 years ago. This is a good one. You guys love the ex-creative team member interviews, and I think you'll really enjoy the Seth Mates interview.
Do you shop at Amazon.com? If so, do you know there's a way for you to support the PW Torch Livecast without doing anything different other than starting your shopping at pwtorch.com/Amazon? When you go to pwtorch.com/Amazon, click on the Amazon link and you land at the Amazon homepage. But anything you buy on that shopping trip, we get a commission for. It's a way to throw a few extra quarters, maybe a couple bucks in the tip jar, as a way to say thanks for what we do here at the PW Torch Livecast. So next time you're about to shop at Amazon, don't type in AMAZ. Stop right there and type in PWT PWTorch.com/Amazon. That's PWTorch.com/Amazon. A free, easy way to help support what we do here at the Livecast. Thank you. Welcome to the PW Torch Livecast. I am Wade Keller, editor and publisher of the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter since 1987, approaching our 25th anniversary later this year, and also, of course, PWTorch.com and the PW Torch apps, and now for over 2 years, one of the hosts of the PW Torch Livecast, and this is Interview Friday, on Friday, March 9th, 2012, and in our continuing series of interviews with former WWE creative team members, I am very pleased to bring aboard 2002 WWE creative team member Seth Mates. Seth, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm guessing everybody else was busy today?
That's not true at all. Don't believe the rumors. Don't believe the rumors. You were not our 50th choice.
It's nice that somebody feels that way.
No, this is great. The timing of this is great, Seth. And one of the reasons I thought this would be great is The Rock's in the news right now. He's back for WrestleMania season. And he's embroiled in an on-air, fascinating series of promo exchanges with John Cena. And you had a chance to work behind the scenes with The Rock in 2002.
Yes,
in the build-up to the Brock Lesnar fight at SummerSlam was one of them, right?
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, so you know what? Before we get too much into The Rock, let me take a little sidebar briefly and have you give a little bit of background on yourself for people who don't know. How did you get a job with WWE, and where do you come from as a wrestling fan?
I've been a wrestling fan my whole life. The show that sucked me in, believe it or not, was SummerSlam 1990. Not the greatest card of all time, but I must have watched that tape 50 times. Been hooked ever since.
Mm-hmm.
I just got very, 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 very lucky. You know, I was in college in the late 90s. I was looking for an internship and sending some stuff to the magazine, actually. In 98, never heard anything. And then in 99, I get a call, hey, do you want to come in and interview for .com? I was like, okay. I thought it was programming, which I like to write. But I was like, you know what, I'll come in, I'll talk to them.
Yeah.
They bring me in for the interview. I talk to a couple people. Of course, my jaw's on the floor the whole time. And then the last person they bring me in to talk to is Shane McMahon. So I'm like, could this get any better?
Yeah.
Lucked into a couple of internships there, impressed the right people, I hope. I was hired full-time. I spent about 2 years with .com and the magazine, where one of my responsibilities for .com was actually to copy and paste all the wonderful Wade Keller news on the PW Torch site and prepare it as part of a daily company report to see what people were saying on the internet, believe it or not. And then had some great experiences there. Got to travel to the shows and write the stories from the pay-per-views and magazines. I loved it. And then in the summer of 2002, Shane McMahon called me and Chris Goff into his office. Chris Goff, who is known as BC from the old Bite This show and all that, and said, you guys ever think about going over to creative? We said, okay, well, we'll give it a shot. We wrote some sample storylines, and, you know, I think we met with Stephanie briefly and stuff, and July of 2002, the week of Vengeance, the week of the Vengeance pay-per-view, we moved over to creative, the two of us together, which worked out well because we were very good friends, and we had both spent years and years in the company, so we had that foundation that actually allowed us to hit the ground running as opposed to what many new creative writers encounter, which is just, holy shit, what kind of a speeding bus on fire did I just jump onto?
Yeah.
And then I had what amounted to a glorified cup of coffee with creative. I was only there from July through December.
Yep.
It was a pretty memorable stretch. I mean, there was a lot of stuff. We split the titles then. Brock was coming into his own. Orton, Batista, Cena were all working their way up. We had the SmackDown 6. We had Hogan was there for a cup of coffee during that run. Michaels had his return match. So, you know, we had Katie Vick, the biggest of them all, of course. So it was a pretty fun stretch. We got to do a lot of very, very, very cool stuff. Can't believe it's been almost 10 years now.
I know. I was just putting up a back issue for VIP members online on the VIP website of the Torch newsletter from 10 years ago this week. And there's an item in there on Randy Orton, and it's just a notebook item that sources tell the Torch that Randy Orton, son of Bob Orton Jr., is considered one of the top prospects they've seen in developmental in a long time. Like, just an item like that, and it's just like, wow, that was, it feels like
I don't know. I guess it feels like 10 years, but it's just fascinating.
If memory serves, he made his TV debut against Bob Holly on the SmackDown right after Backlash that year.
That would be right.
Might have actually been in St. Louis, if I'm not mistaken. I remember he was sitting backstage in one of those big cartons, and one of my colleagues from .com was interviewing him, and it's just one of those memories that I have, but I can't believe it. It's been 10 years.
Yeah.
I'm getting old.
Yeah, yeah. There comes a point when you talk about somebody like Orton where you go, when is he going to find himself, or is this going to be what will he do next as a character, and can he mature? And now he's kind of like the veteran of the locker room, one who has been there for now 10 years or going on 10 years. And when you look around, other than the occasional appearance from a Shawn Michaels or a Rock or Triple H wrestling every now and then, I mean, there's not a lot of guys with that kind of tenure. I mean, Kane, Mark Henry, but it's not a long list now. Randy Orton is in the, just guessing here, probably the top 10 or 20% of tenured guys in that locker room. He's not the young lion anymore.
It's got to be, and again, it makes me feel really old to think that John Cena is only, Orton's only been on TV 3 or 4 months longer than Cena, and Cena's been there almost 10 years, and I remember, I still remember all the backstage pre-tapes we were doing that night of the Halloween party when he rapped for the first time, and now he's the tenured guy. It's amazing, the turnover and just how quickly life goes by.
Excuse me. The phone number here on the live cast is 646-721-9828. 646-721-9828. We invite your questions for Seth Mates, former WWE creative team member, and going back to 2002. And we also invite your emails. If you can't call into the show live, you can email us at pwtorchlivecast@gmail.com. That's pwtorchlivecast@gmail.com. We've got probably about 10 email questions sent in already, and we'll get to those on the show and get to calls also. So feel free to give us a call with any questions you have. Lots of great stories, and the one I want to get to right away, Seth, is John Cena rapping for the first time. Tell that story.
Well, during my time with .com, I worked with a guy named Phil Spear, who, if there's ever was a guy who needs a wrestling blog, it's that guy. He was there backstage.com interviewing the talents probably more than some guys on creative for years. And when we were on .com that summer, he was doing some stories. This is probably early 2002. We were doing some stories about some of the up-and-coming talent for the magazine. And he came over to me one day and he said, "Hey, did you know John Cena can freestyle rap?" And I was like, "That's pretty cool." And I think I might have heard him do it once or twice or something.
Yeah.
And we were in a creative session one time, and if memory serves, somebody was pitching the idea of having Shelton Benjamin maybe come in, something along those lines. And so I mentioned, "Hey, Cena can do it," and it kind of just fell by the wayside. And then we're over in Europe. We were on a UK tour, and we were talking about the SmackDown Halloween show, and Paul Heyman, who was my boss at the time, and I am a Paul Heyman guy. Paul Heyman, who was my boss at the time, asked me to kind of go around to some of the talent and see who they wanted to be for the Halloween show. Maybe we could tailor something to their character, etc. So we were backstage in, where were we? We were probably in England at the time already. And I went up to John and I said, "Hey, John, who do you want to be for the SmackDown Halloween show? Who do you want to dress up as?" And his face just lit up and he said, "You think they'll let me be Vanilla Ice?" And I was like, my face lit up too, because I remembered, what Phil had told me about how he can, freestyle rap. And I said, "Well, I know that you have that talent and stuff, and maybe give you a chance to give you a little bit of on-air time. I think it'd be great. I'm going to pitch it. I think it'd be great." And so it was, I think it was either later that day or the next day, which I think he talks about, I forget who talks about it in their book. Somebody actually tells the story in their book. But we were on a bus ride from, God, my memory is going, but it was definitely a bus ride, and I want to say it was from Sheffield to Manchester or Manchester to Sheffield. We had just done a UK pay-per-view, and we were working our way down or around in England for a live event before we flew back. And myself, Paul, David Lagana, and I believe Stephanie were at the front of the bus, and John and Rikishi, Nydia, and Rey Mysterio, a whole bunch of those guys are in the back of the bus, the SmackDown bus. And he just starts letting out this freestyle rap that just the whole bus was just in awe of it. And, after about a minute or two, huge pop and blah, 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 and everybody loved it, and it was great. Still, we're sitting around, and we're like, okay, who's going to be who? Who's going to be who? And I mentioned that John Cena wants to be Vanilla Ice, and Stephanie didn't think it was a good idea.
Hmm.
She's like, "Oh, no, we can't turn him into a white rapper. It'll bury him, blah, 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 blah." And listen, there's some validity to that because, the white rapper thing helped him get his foot in the door. But if he was still doing that and had been doing that nonstop for 10 years, there's not a lot of meat there. You have to evolve that.
Yeah.
But as a starting point, you know, so I fought for it and Heyman fought for it and stuff, and they went with it. And, you know, I'll never forget, he was smiling that first day of TV. You know, he was smiling. He came up to me and stuff, and, you know, he thanked me, which, I won't forget that. He ran his first rap by me. Which I liked. If you watch the opening scene from that show, the opening scene is just kind of going around the room and a couple things happening, and then they swings around to Stephanie announcing the matches for that night, and you can see John at the table right in front of her, and I'm sitting next to him dressed as the Mountie.
Oh, funny.
So that's a very fond memory from that night and stuff. But I just, you know, made some noise and helped get a start. I take none of the responsibility for that whatsoever. I'm very, very happy for his success, and he was always terrific, terrific, terrific to me. I'm just glad to see them, you know, tap that potential.
Well, at that time, did you look at John Cena as obviously among the young guys? You thought, hey, this guy's got potential. You know, but we think that about a lot of guys. I mean, we thought that about Ken Doan at one point. Where did he go? You know, we thought that about, you know, I mean, you like nothing against Ken Doan. I'm just saying, you know, you kind of look at young guys at that stage in their careers a lot of times and go, do they have the look, the charisma? Do they show potential in the ring? Do they have enough basic athleticism? All that. Cena had all that. But did you see at that point something more special in him than other people at that similar stage?
I think that all of us on SmackDown Creative did. I mean, if you remember, this was actually the day before I joined Creative. There was a main event on SmackDown. I think it was Jericho against... I forget who he was against, but it was the one where Mysterio, he had just made his debut, and he goes to the top of the cage, and he does the dive off the top of the cage onto Jericho.
Mm-hmm.
And that the three people being spotlighted as, like, the future of SmackDown then were Cena, Edge, and Mysterio, which was pretty dead-on accurate.
Yeah.
You know, and that was, you know, Paul Heyman leading the way and Lagana and, you know, a little Michael Hayes and, you know, Vince, Stephanie, Bruce Prichard. I mean, I don't know who exactly set that mix up, but I remember when I left Creative, I said to Paul Heyman, I said, John Cena and Edge are going to be, and I wasn't giving him any news. I just, you know, was giving him my opinion. I said, John Cena and Edge can go anywhere they want to go right now.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And you could see it. Some of these guys, you can see it. You can see that they get it. Sometimes it's like, you know, pulling teeth a little bit, whatever, but... You see a guy like that who's got everything going for him, and the sky's the limit. And you know, the only person who can limit themselves is they themselves, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, sure. No, absolutely. I know what you're saying. And so Cena as a person, I mean, when people make it to the top, you kind of want to know, what were they like before they got to the stage that they're at now? And early on, it seems, I think you used the word terrific, like four times in a row or something like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was a really good guy. You liked him a lot. He was mature, nice guy, humble, but hardworking.
It's hard to really get to know anybody in the wrestling business just because by the nature of the beast, I mean, it's not like it's based purely on talent or based purely on X, Y, or Z. There's so much politics and so much paranoia and so much craziness involved that, yes, there are people who have genuine...
And that was just Monday.
That's every Monday, my friend. I hate to tell you.
Yeah.
Yes, there are people who have genuine friendships, but it's really hard to get to know anybody, like truly get to know them.
Yeah.
The exception to that sometimes is that sort of the guys just starting out, you know, the guys who are coming to TV for the first time or one of the first few times, and they're working the dark matches, or they're, you know, just, you know, jobbing on the big shows or on Jacked or Metal at the time. I don't even know what they're called now. You know, you can sort of get to know them because they're just still regular guys and they're pursuing their dream, but they see you and they BS with you. And I caught myself there.
Yeah.
You know, I always had a lot of very good, you know, interactions with him. You know, I mean, I have a thing on my blog I post, which I just think is funnier more than anything at this point, that, you know, John still owes me $50. You know, we were backstage during that UK tour, and I was wearing one of those WWE shirts with the Union Jack flag in them.
Yeah.
And he looked over at me, and he's like, that's an awesome shirt. Were they selling them out there? I was like, yeah. He goes, and he was already dressed for his match in those horrible neon green tights or whatever he wore at the time. He's like, can you pick two up for me? I'll pay you back when we get back to the States, I promise. I was like, sure. I go out, I get two shirts, I give him, and I wound up giving my notice like a week or two later. And John Cena is a struggling undercard guy. I'm not going to ask him for $50. You know, who knows if he has $50 right now? You know, let him, you know, get to the next town. Little did I know. It's a better story than anything at this point. But John was always great to me. I mean, he really was. I can't say anything bad about him. You know, and that goes for a lot of people. I mean, most of the people there are just genuinely, a lot of them are very good people. They really are.
Did he have a fascination with jorts at that time, jean shorts? You buy
that was the era of the multicolored tights where, you know, if he's coming to, you know, Minnesota, he's wearing the purple for the Vikings.
Yeah.
Remember that era?
Yeah. So you weren't around, you didn't buy him his first pair of jean shorts.
No.
Because if so, we'd have to figure out some sort of punishment. No, it's worked well.
Had nothing to do with that, I swear. No, it was just, I'm not taking credit for any of this, believe
me.
I hope it's not coming across that way. It was just really a fascinating time to be a part of, and I'm glad to be able to help speak up and help make it happen. It was awesome.
Well, Seth, we have like 6-7 emails just came in saying what an ego this guy has taking credit for Cena.
Is one of them from Cena?
No, it's not, although I'm sure he listens.
He does. He should.
Well, The Rock may listen. He takes our advice. Seems like it, but...
If you're like me, you've got a list of your favorite podcasts that you listen to throughout the week and also your favorite websites that you listen to throughout the week, but they don't always overlap. But in the case of PW Torch, they do. We hope not only will you listen to the PW Torch livecast every day, but also visit pwtorch.com every day for the latest insider perspective, breaking news, TV reports, live event reports, live pay-per-view coverage, exclusive editorials, and a wide range of other features. Check it out every day. It's mobile-friendly, desktop and laptop-friendly. Stay up to the minute, stay up to date with pwtorch.com.
I want to move to Rock because you were around Rock also. These are the two guys who are in the news. They've got these heated promos going on television, which the Torch is reporting is legit tension between them. And we'll be talking more about that in different contexts on the VIP side of things. But Rock, in your experience with him behind the scenes, what was Rock like at that stage of his career? Because clearly he had ascended to the very top. But it was around the time, and you can maybe put it in context even better, that it seemed like Hollywood was going to be an option. In the 10 years ago back issue, there was an article, and I can't remember who wrote it, but we're ranking the top champions of the WrestleMania years. And the Torch staff did a roundtable on that in the back issue we just posted from 10 years ago this week. And one of the people writing said, if Rock doesn't go to Hollywood full-time, he can be a headline act for the next 10 years. So just using that as my kind of marker, that was around the time I assume there were some feelings, maybe Rock's in for the long haul, maybe he's not. Talk about what Rock was like then and what the feelings were about his long-term future.
It was pretty well known at that point that Rocky was a part-time player.
Yeah.
By the time when he left after Mania X7 in 2001, which was a year and a half earlier, I think he was making Scorpion King 2 at that point. By that time, it was pretty well established that when he was going to come in, he was going to work a little bit of time, and then he was going to take off and make another movie. You know, he came back for the Invasion debacle and then left again after, you know, WrestleMania 18 to make whatever movie and then came back, you know, right around the time of King of the Ring and Vengeance. I think that was the year he came back early because Austin had left. And so, you know, Vince brought him back a little bit early to help, you know, ease some of that. Rock was already big time. He was already, it was already known that you know, his time was brief and his time was short when he was there. That being said, he was always incredibly, incredibly professional. The biggest compliment I can pay to Rock, which is the biggest compliment I can pay to anybody in the business, is that Rock gets it. Rock is confident enough in his own abilities that he knows that he can do whatever he wants to do and recover from anything, any loss, any this, any that. He can recover. He's knows how to market himself. You know, I can't speak for what was happening in the locker room, nor would I want to. I don't even pretend to, whatever. It's not my thing. And there's a million former workers, I'm sure, who could chime in on that. All I know is that, you know, I was just some little schlub with WWE, WWF.com. But Rock knew the value of making 5 minutes for me so that there would be a story about The Rock and an exclusive soundbite from The Rock, and then, you know, you and some of the other sites would pick that up and there'd be buzz about The Rock. He got that. You know, he knew that as valuable as his time was, hey, if I can make 5 minutes for this little schmuck kid from .com, then that's going to help me. And if I, you know...
Did he call you that?
No.
Oh,
no,
good,
no,
okay.
No, that's what I called me.
No, I know, I'm just joking.
That's what everyone else called me. But no, Rock was, and again, I know I'm sounding like a broken record and whatever, but, you know, Rock was always great to me. I mean, I got to interview Rock 2 minutes after he got out of the ring with Hogan. I got to interview Rock after he made that surprise return the night that Austin wasn't there when he came back and surprised Vince. You know, he made that time. That being said, Rock is also very, 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 very smart. You know, he'll do things if they're okay for business. He's confident in himself, but he's smart. There's a reason why Rock hasn't wrestled on free TV. You know, how many times have we seen money left on the table with moments given away on free TV when they would have sold pay-per-views? Kane unmasking, you know, Bischoff's debut. You know, I know I'm dating myself here with some of these, but those are the ones that just jump to mind instantly.
Yeah.
But Rock was always smarter than that. You know, I remember one week on Creative, we had an idea for an episode of SmackDown where we would do Rock Hogan. And, you know, it would end in a schmoz, but it would just be like a little thing. It would generate some buzz. And we had a really good place we were going with it. And, you know, we got to TV and, you know, Rock didn't want to do Rock Hogan on TV with no buildup, which is smart. I mean, listen, it happens sometimes. We come up with these ridiculous scenarios that are pay-per-view matches, but that we have some place to go with it. And the talent says, I'd rather not go that way. Rock was also smart enough at that time because Rock was still being portrayed as baby face. And he was kind of smart enough to see that things were turning a little bit. You know, especially when we, you know, we rubbed him up with Brock. And again, he made Brock. He made him, you know. He and then, you know, Taker in the months after that made Brock.
Yep.
But he was smart enough to see that the winds were going in the other direction. I don't know if it's an extra on the DVD or what, but after we went off the air at SummerSlam that night, you know, the crowd in New York was just booing the crap out of him. And he got on the mic, completely ad-libbed, and cut a huge heel promo just to kind of test those waters and kind of just see whatever. And when he came back for the run-up to WrestleMania 19, he was a heel. I mean, he knew. He was smart. He got it. He saw that. So I have absolutely all the respect in the world for Rock. To me, Rock and Austin are the two greatest performers in the history of the business ever, bar none. Everybody else is underneath. Not with any disrespect towards anybody else, but to me, the two of them are the standard.
Yeah, well, that's not a hard argument to make. I will say you're not going out on a limb on that one, but, you know, there are other people in the conversation, for sure, but I don't think anyone
should
think, well, what's he talking about? This guy doesn't know anything. I mean, those are good two picks, and you got, we're around them, you know, at a peak time.
Especially, yeah, the interesting thing, too, if just to jump in for 1 second
yeah.
here, is being around Vince right after Austin had walked out. Austin walked out in June. I was there in July.
Yeah.
And so I was starting to, not to change topics here, but this I think this is kind of interesting. I could sort of see a slight shift. You know, it's like I hear some of my other, you know, formerly creative brethren sometimes talking about how, you know, the creative team was harder to adjust to and a little bit more guarded, and there was more of a structure. I mean, when Chris and I started there, Chris Goff and I started there, it was, everybody's there, everybody has a say. I mean, we felt completely comfortable and accepted from the very first moment, and you know, I feel very appreciative for that. But you could sort of see Vince, I mean, this is Austin, this has been his guy forever, and this guy's just walking out on him. So you could kind of see maybe a slightly changing dynamic where, you know, it was like, who really is in my inner circle? Who really can I trust? I remember the Vengeance. We used to have the pay-per-view posters, you know, from like the most 6 or 12 recent pay-per-views hanging around the writer's room. And the one for Vengeance 2002 was originally this one where it was just this tight, tight shot of Austin's eyes.
Yeah.
And I remember it was hanging right over my desk, not because of me, it just happened to be hanging there. And where Vince used to sit at the conference table, faced my desk. And I just remember one day we were in the middle of a pitch about something completely, completely different. And he just looks over at me and he goes, "Can you please take down that poster? I just can't take those eyes looking at me anymore." And it was like, okay, whatever you say, sir.
And I think back to that time, and correct me if my timeline is wrong, but wasn't that when they wanted Steve Austin with no advance notice to do a job on, I think, SmackDown to Brock Lesnar?
Yes.
I mean, like,
that's absolutely the case.
I mean, it was just, to me, that was one of the most suggestions. That was so fraught with politics and even more so just insulting to, as you said, one of the top two all-around wrestlers in the history of this business, or, you know, or at least this generation. I mean, I don't want to compare him to Lou Thesz. It's not, you know, or whatever. I mean, that's apples to oranges. But to ask him with no hype to go in and quote, you know, be a team player, Austin at that point knew the political winds were blowing against him and that there was some... there were nefarious motivations for wanting him to do that, and that he would be happy to job to Brock, but not on 2 days or 3 days' notice with no hype on TV, free on television. And so he, and what he had put his body through, and the risk that he was taking even being in the ring at that point, I just for Vince, even at that moment, in the heat of the moment, to hold that against Austin and to bury him after what he did for him, I think that's about as bad as Bret Hart, because Austin wasn't leaving the company until that was requested of him, whereas Bret was on his way out because, you know, Vince asked him to leave. So I don't know. I mean, I think that's underplayed as a real mistake on Vince McMahon's part in terms of how he treated a great talent. Do you think I'm off on that, or
no? I think you're completely right. I'll caveat this next point by saying that this was just my perception of the situation.
Yeah.
But from what I saw, my perception is that Triple H, and again, Triple H was always very good to me. I have all the respect in the world for him and for his accomplishments. But I also could see the way that the gears were turning on his mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I always felt, and again, my perception, my opinion, meaning no disrespect, but this was just my perception, that he was somewhat jealous of Rock and Austin and of the heights that they reached, which in my opinion, I don't think he's had spectacular accomplishments. To me, he was never at that level.
Right.
Again, my opinion, I'm not trying to, you know, get anybody in trouble.
Yep.
And while Austin was gone with the neck surgery, that's when Triple H started dating Steph. That's when Steph took over creative. The model of the business changed a little bit. Triple H had Vince's ear more and more. And I think that might have been somewhat positioned as, you know, the job to Lesnar as a, you know, okay, well, you know, you've done a lot for us, but now it's time to see if you really are a company guy, if you'll play ball. Like, not quite that severe,
right.
But I think you're absolutely on target with that. And I think especially after Austin left, Triple H and Steph weren't even engaged at that point.
Yeah.
So the direct line to Vince and to Vince's ear, and yes, you know, he built the company around Hunter for a while and all that stuff. I think that there was definitely some changing dynamic there. And Austin leaving the way he did, you never walk out on the business. You know what? If they're asking to do something that's destructive for many, many reasons, sometimes you can't just be a good soldier. You got to stand up for yourself and what's right, especially if you're a guy with the clout of Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Yeah. I knowing what I know about the situation and talking to the people that I was talking about at the time and getting the sense of what was going on, everything you said is consistent with my belief and the beliefs of people I was talking to in the company at the time and involved directly in the situation. And Austin did absolutely the right thing. And the burial on TV is to this day, I mean, I understand when you're paid by, you know, when it's your job and, you know, you have to pick and choose your spots to take a stand. But there were people who participated in that burial of Austin on television who knew better. And it's one of those times where I think more people needed to stand up to Vince. And at that point, Triple H wasn't in power, like you said. But he at least had some people's ear and had some influence on things. And
we had a TV in Houston at some point during my run. And my run was, from September to December. So the TV in Houston was probably September or October. And Vince and Steve had a meeting while we were in Texas for that run, whenever that was. Like a face-to-face meeting during that run.
Yep.
And at some point during my run, too, I believe it was probably closer to October, we just started talking in very broad terms about what matches could be the top three or four matches at WrestleMania. And I don't think any of it was really set in stone. I think just, you know, Gortz had put together just some options and some whatever. And all four scenarios had Austin in a match. So, yes, there was tension, but there was communication, and it was, you know, it wasn't ever like, oh, that son of a bitch is never coming back. He was part of the plans not too long after he walked out.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the matches, by the way, that was down in one of the scenarios, which I'll never forget, was Austin against Scott Steiner.
Oh, man.
Can you imagine?
No. I mean, Scott was fresh off of being a top guy in WCW, but he was a top guy in WCW because, like, six other top guys got hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, Scott was way past his prime at that point. It still amazes me, given what I've heard about the stretching routine he has to put himself through just to be able to go walk to the ring. But even back then,
he's got some buzz in him. He's a star, but you're not going to put a guy with a history of severe neck injuries who's limited to begin with, you know, a guy who can't protect him. You know what I mean?
Right. That's right. I mean, that's just. I mean, that's one of the levels of the business that you can fantasy book, but there, at some point you got to take into consideration, you know, the reality, and that's one of the things that sometimes doesn't land on people's radars. It has to be the right matchup for the right chemistry has to exist in the ring for two top guys or, you know, semi-top guys to be against each other. And I mean, and that was a time too for, and I don't, I'm not staring at the entire roster, but if you're not going to have Austin go against a true top guy, don't have him go against somebody who's older than him. You know, have him be in the ring with someone he can give a little rub to.
Absolutely. I mean, some of the stuff they were doing with him and Eddie Guerrero before he walked out, while it wasn't the, you know, most creatively wonderful thing in the world, at least it was new and fresh and felt like they were doing something different and not just Austin Taker for the 10,000th time.
You are listening to the PW Torch Livecast. I'm host Wade Keller, joined by former WWE creative team member Seth Mates. We're talking a lot about 2002, and I had a focus early on John Cena and The Rock. We'll get into some other personalities as the show progresses. You are welcome to call us.
If you're like me, you've got a list of your favorite podcasts that you listen to throughout the week and also your favorite websites that you listen to throughout the week, but they don't always overlap. But in the case of PW Torch, they do. We hope not only will you listen to the PW Torch livecast every day, but also visit pwtorch.com every day for the latest insider perspective, breaking news, TV reports, live event reports, live pay-per-view coverage, exclusive editorials, and a wide range of other features. Check it out every day. It's mobile-friendly, desktop and laptop-friendly. Stay up to the minute, stay up to date with pwtorch.com.
Seth, why don't we dive into phone calls and emails? Area code 601, you are first in line. Please state your name and where you're from.
Sergeant Kevin Robinson, Jackson, Mississippi.
Hey, Kevin, how you doing?
All right. Can you hear me good?
Yeah, I hear you fine. Maybe a little soft.
Doing, Kevin?
Yeah, I got my headphones on. I was making sure. All right, Seth, here's a question I want to ask you because I just tuned in. You were getting on a touchy person that I don't like too well still this day, Triple H. The factor regarding him, his backstage factor, I'm sorry, just like John Cena, I can't stand Triple H because when I found out what he was all about, his backstage manipulating, you know, the way he was jealous of The Rock and Stone Cold, and then he married, everybody know why he married Stephanie, so he can get a piece of business. But
Sarge, it's one, I'm going to jump in. It's one thing to say a lot of, I think there's a lot of truth in what you say about some jealousy with Triple H and playing politics and being around at a time when Rock and Austin. But I got to jump in when you start speculating that he married his wife with whom he has children. They have had a marriage that has lasted a long time only to gain political power or even in part to gain political power. I just think that's a little speculative.
No, it's not. It's the truth. I'm sorry. It's been discussed before. But that's how I feel. I mean, come on now.
All right.
What other wrestlers have done that before?
I think there's two people who shared a lot in common, who had similar crazy jobs and spent a lot of time on the road together and enjoyed each other's company and fell in love. I don't think Steph. I don't want to get too sidetracked here, Sarge, but to say that Stephanie McMahon fell in love with somebody who was using her to gain power in the wrestling industry, I think is a little insulting to somebody of Stephanie's stature and intelligence and the strong personality and perceptiveness that she has. If she was like this, you know, the adultish daughter who couldn't really tie her own shoes without help, and this really smart Triple H Mary, I mean, okay, maybe you could start speculating about that. But anyway, I don't want to get too sidetracked. I just, when people say that, I'm just like, come on, there's no evidence of that. Seth, back me up here or back up Kev. Ooh, the interesting pause.
I don't want to jump too much into this one. I mean, I have my perception of the situation, but my perception of the situation is just that. It's my perception, and I wouldn't want somebody looking at me or my life or my world through their eyes without knowing what was really going on.
Fair enough.
I would rather stay out of it. I mean, I skew a little bit more towards you, Wade.
Yeah. But Kevin's not. You don't think Kevin's completely crazy?
I don't think he's completely crazy. No.
Okay.
I don't think he's completely crazy.
All right.
But I'd rather not get into it too much. But one thing I will say is that, you know, the two of them being together, it doesn't, you know, from a business standpoint, doesn't just benefit Triple H. You know, I mean, Triple H has an ingenious mind for the business, and, you know, Stephanie's the one with the keys to the kingdom right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but I don't want to get into it. It's speculation on my end. I'd rather not get into it too much. But, you know, the thing about the situation is it is what it is, and so, you know.
Yeah. All right, well, I put Sarge on hold, because Sergeant Kevin on hold, because we're getting some background noise. So I'm going to try back. If the background noise is too bad, I'll ask you to wrap up pretty quick, Kevin. But, yeah, we're hearing a lot of background noise. Go ahead and wrap up your point, though. I'm sorry for jumping in.
Okay, sorry, the background noise was causing the headphones. Okay, I'm at work at the post office, so I got a lot of machinery on back. But, yeah, I'm sorry. I called it how I see it, because this Thursday coming up, I'll be 41. So I grew up with wrestling back during the old Saturday night when NWA was on TBS at 5 p.m. So I remember seeing all the this wrestler married this wife, like when Steve Austin did that with Chris Williams' wife, and you know that kind of stuff. But then the magnitude of Triple H, I'm sorry, I just called it how I saw it, Wade. I mean, that's what I got out of it.
By the way, this is a small thing, but if you're going to talk about World Championship Wrestling on Saturdays, you got to say 505, not 5.
Like I said, I'm showing my age. I can't remember. At least I was close. I was close. Now I grew up with Mid South, UWF. Back when wrestling was wrestling.
Hey, we're within a couple months of each other in age. You're speaking my language. But anyway, I didn't mean to sidetrack you on. You were talking about Hunter. So go ahead and wrap up your question for us.
Well, I was just wrapping up. That's pretty much all of what I had. I called it how I saw it. And he married Stephanie to, you know, gain power. And I knew that some of the guys back in the back were looking like, oh, great. We know what he's planning on doing. And, you know, since he can't get the star power on his own, he just did what he had to do.
I want to transition that, Seth, to a question for you. I appreciate the call, Sarge. Do you think that Triple H is got over the last 10 years, got more main event clout, more pushes, benefits of the doubt, more opportunities because of his relationship with Stephanie? Or did you think from your time in WWE and watching as a fan before he got there that Triple H would have had pretty much this career either way, especially when you take into context the competition that he was ahead of and that he surpassed or that were never able to get to his level? Do you think that Triple H actually got more main events and a bigger push than he deserved because of Stephanie, or would he have had the same career?
Definitely the former. I'll add the preface. I think he's a spectacular performer. I think he's had great matches. I think I enjoy watching him most of the time. But the staying at the top, even when he wasn't what should have been at the top, the positioning himself above other talents, which we saw just this past summer with the CM Punk stuff, where CM Punk is running away with things and Triple H comes back and, you know, is positioning himself to glom some of that heat away. Even Mania this year. I mean, this is actually a good segue, because this is something, you know, one of my big points that I've been discussing on the Twitter page about Mania this year. Is Mania this year is being sold on three things. One, the WrestleMania name. Two, Rock versus Cena. Three, The Undertaker going for 20-0. You sprinkle in a WWE title match, a world title match, you know, the Divas, maybe a mainstream celebrity, and I find it very, very hard to believe that there's not a single person out there based off of that lineup who's not going to buy WrestleMania. And I find it very, very hard to believe that there's a single person out there who, even with all that, is on the fence and, oh, well, let's do Triple H against The Undertaker again. Listen, they have a very, very good story to tell, but in 4 weeks, when neither one of them is on TV for the next 6 months, when they're trying to sell me the main event of Extreme Rules is, you know, Sheamus against Randy Orton or whatever it's going to be, and these are the guys in the second and the third match, not the guys who did, 45 minutes in a Hell in a Cell. That, to me, is it going to be a great match? Yes, it's going to be a great match. But what's the cost? The cost is positioning. The cost is you're not taking a guy who's going to be working house shows, a guy who is going to be on Raw week in and week out after April 1st, and you're not positioning them with The Undertaker or with Triple H. You know, you're not sending the message, yeah, this guy's as big a star as Taker, and yeah, he's going to lose, but you know what? Triple H is going to lose. You know, they're not going to end the streak. There's no money in ending the streak.
Yeah. They're not even talking. I mean, this is about the hype for this match has been about Triple H and Undertaker compared to Shawn Michaels and Undertaker. It's not even about the streak. I mean, so far, they haven't talked a lot about the streak. Hunter hasn't said, I want to be the one to end the streak. Instead, it's been, I don't want to lose twice like Shawn did, or I'm going to prove that I'm better than Shawn. And I think it was a great angle on Monday. I loved it. And I don't even disagree with much of anything, if anything, you said about Triple H politically and that he got himself ahead based on that. But I thought what he and Sean did on Monday was one of, I mean, it was really good, compelling television.
It absolutely was. I'm sorry to jump in. It was.
Yeah.
It absolutely was great, compelling television. But you tell a story with, by way of example, these are completely arbitrary. You know, Triple H against Cody Rhodes, Triple H against Sheamus, which I know they did a couple years ago at Mania, Undertaker versus Punk, Undertaker versus whoever.
Yeah.
And you're not going to see Undertaker fighting Triple H, and then Shawn is the ref, and then inside Hell in the Cell tells me two things. First of all, it tells me that Taker is it might be banged up or whatever, because they're adding a lot of bells and whistles to this match.
Yep.
They're adding a lot of bells and whistles to this match. Anytime you see that kind of stuff happening, you know, somebody's limited.
Yep.
Just speculation again on my part, and not speaking from a know-it-all, but that's how it works.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing it tells me is that it's just purely, hey, I'd like to fight Undertaker. Because, like I said, it's not going to sell a single extra pay-per-view. Making it a Hell in the Cell match, to me, it was the biggest question mark. Like, why? Why make it Hell in a Cell? What do you gain with Hell in a Cell? If anything, you lose a little bit of the luster of the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view because it's not as special.
Yeah.
You lose the rumored Money in the Bank match they were going to do. You're not going to do two big gimmick matches at the same pay-per-view because then, you know, the second one doesn't mean as much as the first one does.
Yeah.
So to me, it's just, I don't understand it. You know, it's a four-hour pay-per-view. And, you know, Rock Cena, which, you know, it's you know, Rock's not going to be around much after Mania. Cena will probably, I don't know what his schedule is after Mania, but that's an hour out of the 4 hours right there.
Yeah.
The packages, the introductions, the match, the heat, blah, 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 blah. It's 45 minutes to an hour. And now you're devoting 25% of your biggest show of the year to a segment that didn't sell you any extra pay-per-views and involving three participants who are not working house shows and won't be working pay-per-views or Raws until SummerSlam, if not until next year's WrestleMania.
I think one of the big lost opportunities that will in retrospect, be seen as part of WrestleMania 28 is elevating somebody else. And CM Punk and Jericho, if Jericho had been protected and portrayed as a big deal, I think within about 3 weeks of coming back and doing the no-talking speech, he was just another guy. And he's a top guy, but another top guy, but not.
Be careful what you say. Be careful what you say, by the way, because I said the same thing on my Twitter page, and Jericho tweeted for me to F off.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Did you see that?
No, I did.
He took it down within a couple hours.
Well, that's classy.
Yeah, it was fun. It was nice and stuff. It was somebody tweeted, it's like, wow, I haven't seen that much fire out of Jericho since he came back. I want to see Mates Jericho at Mania now.
I'm not even blaming Jericho. I mean, it might be Jericho's fault. Part is fault, not as at all his fault. But I'm sorry, he is not being portrayed from right. a pure promotional respect as anything special at this point. So
and Punk that exchange with Punk and Jericho last week to me that was like, okay, now I want to see this match. You know, I'm not the kind of person who gets excited like, yes, I'm going to get a 5-star match. I need a little bit of sizzle.
Oh, absolutely.
And that promo last week was awesome, and what Punk said is exactly right. He said, you might have beaten Rock and Austin on the same night, but you were never the guy.
Yep.
And that's what positioning is. You know, it doesn't matter what titles you hold, who you beat. You know, if the NWO and Rock and Austin and Triple H are in the Seg 1, the Overrun, and then Seg 11 like they were back then, and you're the undisputed champion beating Rhino in Seg 3, with all due respect to Rhino, people aren't going to look at you as a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, and I love Jericho. Jericho's a phenomenal, phenomenal performer. But I wasn't looking forward to any of that until last Monday.
I think, like, even on Impact last week, they had a main event where Magnus and Austin Aries were in the main event. It was a six-man tag, and the announcers drew attention to it, and I liked it. It didn't draw a great rating, but it, you know, went up against the Miami Heat game on TNT, and the NBA's been a ratings juggernaut this year. Ratings are up, and I think that has been affecting Impact, especially when you can see the ratings drop when the Heat game starts, which it happened to start an hour and a half into Impact. So I wouldn't blame it, but I'm even willing to accept taking a half a step back in order to put wrestlers in a position to that where the slot itself can elevate them. And I think having the X Division champion in a main event, I'm a proponent of having X title matches. If you have 12 pay-per-views a year, I think three of them, the X title match should be in the main event. Not
the
because
home,
necessarily...
Go home segment.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Wait.
Yeah.
The go-home segment for WrestleMania in 2000 on SmackDown, do you remember what the go-home match was for WrestleMania 2000, which was at the time the biggest one they ever had?
I don't remember.
It was Stephanie McMahon winning the women's title from Jackie. Was the go-home segment for WrestleMania 2000. If positioned right, if you tell the right story,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I completely
no,
agree.
Good example. And so I think that the WrestleMania itself, you like the argument you're making, the case that you're making is take advantage of what it means to be in a top match at WrestleMania or to be against Undertaker, even if it doesn't, quote, help the buy rate. If you think you've got enough other buy rate generating happenings going on, use the slot, the value of WrestleMania to elevate somebody else. So I like that approach, and I get what you're saying. Absolutely.
We know you're a pro wrestling fan because you're listening to the PW Torch livecast. There's a good chance you're also a fan of the UFC and all of mixed martial arts. And if so, we hope you'll check out our sister website at MMATorch.com, covering the news of MMA every single day with breaking news, exclusive analysis, an array of columns, live event coverage, flashbacks, and so much more. Check it out. That's MMATorch.com or download the free MMA Torch app in the iPhone and Android app stores. That's MMATorch.com.
Yeah, I mean, listen, Triple H versus Undertaker inside Hell in a Cell is a phenomenal, phenomenal attraction. I'm not remotely questioning that. But it's not going to sell you one extra WrestleMania pay-per-view buy.
Yeah.
Do it at the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view. Do it at Extreme Rules. Do it at one of these. Do it at SummerSlam. You know, do it at a time when you're not already looking at a million buys. And again, it goes to, you know, one of the reasons why last year's Mania was kind of, I was at last year's Mania, it was kind of anticlimactic when people were leaving.
Yeah.
Because you had your main event with Cena and Miz, with, you know, two guys who are on TV every week who are working the house shows and all that stuff. And then you had Rock, who, you know, again, I love him, but he's a part-time player. And he comes out and basically pisses all over the main event and pisses all over the two guys who I'm now supposed to want to pay $50 to watch in the rematch the next month on pay-per-view.
Yeah.
You know, well, and so they sold a million extra WrestleMania pay-per-views, you know, and, you know, Rock deserves not all the credit, but a lot of the credit for that. So, you know, they made a lot of money. So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm looking at it the wrong way. But you look at what was lost in other pay-per-views, and listen, if it wasn't for CM Punk, 2011 for WWE would have been a disaster. In a lot of ways. I mean, you know, they...
Although, Seth, it did increase the ratings. It did increase the buy rate. The John Cena-R-Truth match did as well as anything that Punk did other than SummerSlam, but that was SummerSlam. I don't think the CM Punk thing was... I think it was something that got people on the internet talking, and I was a fan of a lot of aspects of what Punk did, but I don't even think... I think Vince McMahon is sort of a little cool on him and has him in this spot, which isn't a bad spot, but it's not, you know, the headline spot. In part because I don't think Punk ever moved the needle, and I think a lot of that was booking him in a position where he looked bad by coming back at all. But it's not like, other than the great crowd heat in Chicago, it's not like he really popped ratings or buy rates. So
The Money in the Bank buy rate was popped. I mean, there was definitely interest in tuning in to see that match. I mean, he moved the needle there. And in terms of ratings week in and week out, first of all, without head-to-head competition from Nitro, which, you know, again, was just with people within the business themselves, you're not going to see that. People are so used to having the rug pulled out from under them now in terms of investing in these new stars that it's going to take a significant investment. It's going to take some time for that needle to move. I mean, you look at the Raw ratings from when Austin won King of the Ring until he became champion 2 years later. It takes some time.
Yeah.
And people are so used to the dynamic now. And again, this goes to positioning, and this goes to some of the you know, the games backstage.
Yeah.
That, you know, the fans will tune in if there's a talent that they believe in and who they know that if they get on board for the ride, that they're going to have an exciting trip. There's not going to be any staggers along the way. It's going to be must-see TV. And even if there's a couple of trips along the way, I'm going to hitch my wagon up to this guy because I can believe in him and what they're doing and where they're going with him.
Yeah.
The only person who's had that in the last 10 years who didn't have it before is Cena. The only one. So you're exactly right. You bring, you know, Punk wasn't going to, you know, change the ratings in any big dramatic long-term way from the beginning because the fans have been crapped on so many times in terms of investing in that. I mean, hell, who the hell's the Raw general manager in that storyline that we were asked to care about? You know, I mean, they want the audience to treat their programming like must-see TV, but they don't treat it like must-see TV. People will tune in if you give them that consistency and if you don't have these herky-jerky pushes and all that all the time. And there are some people backstage who know that. And so, and this is, you know, this is, you know, was one of my complaints about when they were building Jericho back in the day, is that Jericho came in, and remember that night that he, you know, they did the false finish where he won the title and then they reversed it and stuff, but it was a huge pop, it was a huge moment, got a great rating and all that.
Yeah.
And then the next week he's back to feuding with, you know, X-Pac or whoever.
Yeah.
You know, you can't do that. I mean, if fans want to go along for that ride, as soon as they lose faith in someone, it takes a lot to get their faith back in him. And the Punk thing was great, and there was buzz, and it felt real. But, as, again, he, like you said, he came back to TV too early, and the Triple H COO character was exactly the opposite of what they should have done. You know, Punk's character was a babyface rejecting the status quo.
Yeah.
What they should have brought in was Triple H as a heel representing what Triple H was, the DX character, the Attitude Era, and all that stuff, and then have, you know, you have a clear good guy, a clear bad guy, and you have a, an issue for them to fight over. Instead, Triple H came in as a babyface, which made no sense, and as an authority figure. And Punk's not against authority. He's against status quo. So it confused a lot of people, and the Nash thing didn't help, and don't get me started on that. And so it just turned into another, well, you know, it started really good, but and then what happens backstage is exactly what you think happens backstage. Well, I just don't know if he has it, and da-da-da. And I don't know that that happened this time exactly, but I still think that, you know, Punk entertains the crap out of me. And even with the herky-jerky pushes, I'm still a fan, and I don't think we've even come close to seeing his ceiling yet.
Yeah. All right, let's go back to the phone lines and go next to area code 281, then 724 and 347, you are on deck. And if you do want to give us a call, Seth, can you stay? We're going live for 1 hour. Can you stay in overtime with us if we take more calls and emails?
Sure, absolutely, no
Great.
Problem.
So if anybody wants to get on hold now, we'll hold you over and take your phone call even past the bottom of the hour, past the 1 hour that people can listen live. And the phone number, again, is 646-721-9828. Talk to us about today's WrestleMania. Talk to us about what was going on in WWE 10 years ago. Anything you want. Heck, if you got a question about TNA, we'll take it. I'm sure Garrett Bischoff is the buzz of the wrestling world right now. Who's his partner? All right, or Abyss's brother. Talk about Abyss's brother. All right, area code 724, you are up next. Thanks so much for holding. Please state your name and where you're from. Let me hit the button correctly here. There we go.
This is David.
724. I'm sorry,
Pittsburgh.
I talked over you. Please state your name now.
Dave in Pittsburgh.
All right, cool. Thanks.
Hey, Dave. How you doing?
All right. For a second there, it's kind of like the first episode of MMA Unleashed or whatever, Spike TV show with Nick Diaz, where it was just talking over each other. Anyway, go ahead.
I got on a little late. So my first question is, Seth, were you around in early 2002?
Yes. I wasn't on creative yet. I was with .com and the magazine then, but I was around then, yes.
Okay, well, you'll still probably be able to answer my question. I'll ask that in a second, but I wanted to chime in a little bit on the Triple H Undertaker match. I'm looking forward to that match more than anything right now. I like the added Hell in a Cell stipulation because I think it was used properly. They have a pay-per-view Hell in a Cell for the past 3 years, and they throw matches together with no build-up at all. Just throw them in a cell because it's, you know, the pay-per-view in October, whereas for WrestleMania, I mean, it seems like, you know, both those guys are famous for Hell in a Cell matches, and, you know, I guess it's the final encounter between them, so I think Hell in a Cell is a good idea.
And that's a valid point, but let me ask you this. If it wasn't Triple H versus Undertaker Hell in a Cell, would you be ordering WrestleMania anyway?
Well, yeah.
Well, that's exactly my point there, is that you're ordering WrestleMania, you've got Rock Cena, you've got title matches, you've got glitz and glamour, you know you're going to get high-profile matches with Triple H and Taker anyway. So you've got this incredibly awesome attraction, and I'm not trying to downplay how good of an attraction it is. Why do it at an event that's not going to make you extra money? They've already got your $50. So
right.
They can give you value without giving you something that could be a complete attraction unto itself and watering down other long-term attractions in doing so. That's my point.
Yeah.
Well, I agree with that. That's definitely a great point. But if, I mean, I guess it makes more sense if this is actually like their final match together, end of an era, all that stuff that they're hyping. I mean, I can see why they're going with Hell in a Cell. I mean, I like it, but you're right. I would order WrestleMania regardless because it's WrestleMania. So I see that point of view. But the question I had has nothing to do with current day, but could you provide a little backstage insight to when Stone Cold abruptly left the company after WrestleMania 18?
you could I'll take you back to WrestleMania 18 weekend. I did an interview with him for .com backstage at one of the Access sessions. And, you know, just talking just about the usual generic stuff. And one of the questions I said to him, I was like, so, you know, the NWO's here. And this is back when .com used to do a lot of, like, real shoot stuff. And we really, really tried to cater to the real hardcore internet audience. And the talent all knew that. And like I said, this is about 2 days before WrestleMania. So this is about 3 days before his first walkout. And he said to me, you know, I ain't real happy with how things are going right now, being conducting from a creative standpoint, and I think a lot of guys are being sacrificed. You know, basically a lot of the stuff that he would then say later during that Bite This interview, you know, a few months later. But he said it to me, and he knew I was recording it. He knew I you know, could have put it up on the website, but you could see even then that he was, and I don't know how long it had been building, you could tell that even then he wasn't thrilled. And, you know, there was some buzz that, you know, the month before when he had the match with Jericho at No Way Out, that he was just kind of not happy, and it wasn't a great match, and, you know, contributed to, you know, Jericho's, you know, at the end of his run as champion, not going on as long as it probably could have. But he was in a bad mood to begin with, and then, you know, I was asked by some not to post that on the website, and we touted ourselves as reporters. We knew where our bread was buttered, and we knew when where to draw the line.
Yeah.
But the day of WrestleMania 18, I you know, went up to him backstage and I said hello, and I asked him if he might have a few minutes for me after his match, which was standard fare. I mean, Phil Spear and I used to be backstage at all the pay-per-views and set things up early in the day and, hey, do you mind if I grab you for a few minutes after your match? Just so they'd be, you know to look for us and make a few minutes and how do you think it went and blah, blah, blah. And he said, no problem. He was in a good mood. You know, we were working on a special issue of the magazine about Undertaker at the time. So he gave me some quotes for that. He was in a good mood. And he had the match with Hall at Mania. And then after the match at Mania, I went over to talk to him and he just completely blew me off.
Hmm.
Completely blew me off. I think he even mentions that in his book, you know, as part of the, you know, whatever. And it was the next day was the first time he walked out. A lot of people remember the second walkout, but not the first walkout. And the first walkout necessitated some rewrites also, because at the time they were of the understanding that he was going to come back the following week for the first draft show, which was when they did the brand separation, which I can't believe it's been 10 years now. God, I'm old. But the main event, the first draft show, Rock was the first pick on SmackDown. I think Taker wound up being the first pick on Raw. The first pick on Raw was supposed to be Austin.
Yep.
The main event of that first draft show was supposed to be Rock versus Austin in the battle of the draft picks for the last time in God knows how long, and it was going to be a schmoz and all the guys running in, and I think, and boom, there's your show.
Mm-hmm.
And that show needed a complete rewrite also. You know, he wound up coming back a few weeks later, and it was like, okay, well, you know what, he blew off some steam and whatever, but that was the same scenario. So you could see that building, you know, you could see that. And, you know, I think that, you know, when he was coming back, I should say when he turned heel at 17 and he was a heel for much of 2001, the thinking was that he was going to stay a heel through Hunter's comeback. He was going to hold the title through Hunter's comeback, and then he would drop the title to Hunter in the main event of 18. That was the plan. It changed because I don't know if it was, again, this is speculation, I don't know if it was a merchandise thing or just because people didn't like seeing him as a bad guy. And it's funny because Vince used to complain every once in a while in creative sessions about, man, I wish Steve had just, you know, stayed a heel. It would have been so much better. And like, he used to say that.
Yes.
But Steve asked to be turned back babyface. And so you could see it from the beginning. And again, when he walked out the second time, it's not like it was that markedly different from the first time. And I flew to California the week after that to do that cover story for the magazine about what everybody was saying about it. And everybody was very honest about it and very upfront about it. And it was just kind of this, that thing that it just wasn't unexpected. It was just sad how it had happened and everybody just hoped it ended okay.
Yeah. Dave, you have anything else for us?
No, that's all.
Does that answer your question?
No. Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to get, you know, I've heard a lot of stories, you know, everywhere, and I just wanted to get someone else's perspective that was behind the scenes.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, I wasn't, like I said, I wasn't as, you know, inner circle at the beginning of the year as at the end of the year, but that's all, you know.
When was your tenure over?
My last week at TV was Thanksgiving week of 2002. The main event of the last show I worked was the big show against Fabulous Moolah, no joke.
God.
and then my last official day with the company was December 6th of 2002.
Thanks.
Dave, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thanks for the call, man.
Yep.
When you're looking to tune in live to the PW Torch Livecast, find out about the next episode, or just catch up on an episode you missed, go to our new website, pwtorchlivecast.com. You can select shows by specific day, specific host, and format, including a grid of our latest interviews and best of selections on the homepage. That is pwtorchlivecast.com, where you can stream our show live and listen to past shows on demand. That's pwtorchlivecast.com.
All right, let's go to our next caller here. Area code 347. You're on with Seth Mates, former WWE creative team member in 2002. Please state your name and where you're calling from.
Hello, this is Christian, New York. My question is for Seth. Do you think that wrestling fans are correct when they actually think that Vince McMahon needs like motivation from TNA to make his product better? Don't you think that's like a ridiculous notion that McMahon is not trying as hard as he is right now, that he actually needs some sort of competition from an external force to actually motivate him? Don't you think that's ridiculous?
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, and that was a unique time for you, Seth, when you were there, as Chris was bringing up. The lack of competition from WCW, I don't think there's any doubt, and this is where the TNA thing comes in, Seth, is Vince was very motivated and willing to take chances and change in ways he would not have had Eric Bischoff not led this WCW Nitro revolution. And so people look at that and go, oh, Vince is at his best when his back is against the wall, when he's really pushed. So I think people sometimes look at TNA as, well, shouldn't he get the same inspiration from them? But, you know, TNA isn't beating him in the ratings. TNA isn't stealing his talent. TNA isn't drawing big arena crowds. I talked about this yesterday on the VIP Keller Hotline. It's just not at the level it needs to be for that. So you can answer Chris's question however you want, but I guess I would augment onto it. Did you sense Vince's motivation in 2002 would have been better had WCW still been a strong company?
I think Vince, like many leaders of his ilk, I think that he motivates himself, but I think that competition makes them innovate, makes them do things that they might not normally do. I think if you look back at the history of the company, I think that their willingness to elevate talent to the upper heavens and to truly change and revolutionize the business is directly proportional to how much their back is to the wall. You know, I mean, Steve Austin would not have gotten the chance that Steve Austin did in 1996 if WWF hadn't been doing 1-6s and WCW wasn't doing 4s and 5s. The business model as it's set up now is absolutely foolproof. They're going to make money whether, you know, they draw a 4 rating or a 3 rating. Obviously, they want to get 4s whenever they can. But I do think that from what I saw, Vince's personality type is he has no attention span. he can be erratic, very smart man, an absolute genius. I mean, the Vince McMahon, the best thing I ever learned from Vince McMahon was be smart enough to know when you don't know something. And I know that might sound a little silly given, oh, I always hear these stories about Vince McMahon and his bluster and his this and his that. Well, Vince is smart enough to know that even Vince has limitations, and that's been the secret of his success, is you surround yourself by a lot of people who are as smart, if not smarter, than you. And he does have that with all the requisite, you know, yes men and all that also that comes with the fame and the money and the power. I think the mistake that he would be making would be to be looking at TNA as the competition. You know, I mean, having worked in the newspaper business, you know, it's like the newspaper business's competition isn't other newspapers. It's everything. You know, wrestling's competition isn't just other wrestling. It's everything. There's media everywhere. You're fighting everybody. You know, UFC is competition. Everything is competition. You know, it's not like you just have to win your time slot. Well, there's on-demand, and there's mobile, and there's Twitter, and there's everything. And so It wouldn't make sense from a business standpoint to just kind of tear up the model and try and like blow up the kitchen and see what's there, and just tear it all apart, because they're making money right now. And so, yes, a lot of it will be plateaued, you know, with some minor ups and some minor ups and downs. But why would they take some massive risk or do something ridiculous and reinvent the wheel if they don't have to? And I'm talking about it in some dramatic, drastic way. When you risk, there's the risk versus reward. It's not even a question mark. The risk is just too great. You know, they've built a foolproof model. I don't know if that makes sense. Hello?
Sorry about that. Do you think there's anything, as a follow-up onto that, Seth, that TNA has ever seemed as something that would land on Vince's radar, knowing him the way that you know him?
It's hard for me to say. I mean, I wasn't working with him intimately during the Monday Night Wars, so it's not like I can speak to. I mean, listen, you've interviewed Russo and Ferrara. I mean, those interviews probably have a way more insight than I can give you on what he's like when there's direct competition like that. From what I saw of Vince, he's one of those people who is always looking to squeeze every drop out of every segment, every talent he can. And yes, there's people around him who kind of manipulate that. And yes, there's times he doesn't feel comfortable with certain things, but I don't know that he looks at them as competition. I think the second that they start stepping up, he'll sign away three or four of their top guys and put them right back where he wants to keep them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I just don't think so. And I think that that's actually an asset for TNA, that they can stay underneath the radar.
Yeah.
You know, because otherwise, you know, they risk having their talent raided or whatever. I mean, all the stuff that Vince used to accuse Ted Turner of is the same stuff that Vince has done for years and years and years, too.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, let's go to our next phone call here. Area code 281. Thanks for holding. Please state your name and where you're from.
Hey, guys. Jay out of Houston. How you doing?
Doing good. Good to hear from you, Jay. What have you got for Seth?
How you doing?
All right, my question is about Triple H from 2002. It seems like he's been the most polarizing figure of today's live cast. Did you watch him kind of finagle his way into splitting the world title into two different brands and becoming the centerpiece of Raw? Because I know during that time up until November, he held that World Heavyweight Championship in the first reincarnation. And what did you think of that?
Triple H was not the one directly behind splitting the titles. I mean, at the time, the brand extension started that March, but it wasn't until we brought in Stephanie and Bischoff as the GMs that there was a real concerted effort to really try and give each brand its own unique identity, even the announcers, the titles, et cetera. You know, and there was a lot of question marks. We had a lot of very serious meetings about you know, what to do and whether to split the titles and stuff. And hey, listen, I'm young. I mean, I was 23 when I was on creative, for God's sakes. But I was, you know, old school in terms of I loved having the one title, but understood that having two titles would probably be better. In terms of him being the one with that title, yeah, he was behind that. The original plan was, and again, if you remember the timeline, you know, Brock beat Rock at SummerSlam in August to win the title, walked out of Madison Square Garden the next night as what was now the SmackDown champion. The main event at the Garden that night was the number one contenders match, which was, by the way, Triple H versus Undertaker. Triple H won the match. At SummerSlam, we had put the Intercontinental title on Rob Van Dam, with the thinking being that it would be the most logical way to establish this brand-new champion out of nothing would be to have the Intercontinental champion, which at the time was the only secondary title we had, take on the number one contender. Seemed like it would legitimize the title a little bit, and the plan all along was for Rob Van Dam to be that guy. A few weeks before the show happened, it somehow came up, and I'm going to hedge this a little bit because I don't know what the exact conversations were, et cetera, that you know, winning a title that didn't exist before out of nowhere is a heel thing to do. And it would mean more if Triple H were the champion going into the match because he was a heel, and then when Van Damme won it, you know, it would be a babyface thing that just happened. So the idea came up that when it was a show in Wisconsin, I think, for Bischoff to just present Triple H with the title. Again, the plan was still for Van Damme to win the title at Unforgiven. And then, you know, a couple weeks before Unforgiven, there was just the things thrown out there. We, you know, is he ready? Is he this? People have been, you know, it's funny because they say we listen to what the audience wants. People have been cheering RVD for freaking a year and a half. You know, there was talk of putting the title, taking the title, the WWF title off Austin and putting it on Van Damme late in 2001. That's how over the guy was at the time. But, oh, no, I don't know if he has it. You know, we really want to make this kid, and now just isn't the time, and blah, 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 blah. All these excuses, and that was when I started to see the laundry list of, because one of the things about Vince is that it doesn't matter what the idea is, you have to know how to pitch him.
Yeah.
You know, you have to know how to pitch Vince. You never raise your voice. You always ask questions. You know, would it make any sense if we did this? Maybe we should try this. You know, again, there's techniques, and Triple H knew every one of them. You know, like, for example, when you hear something online that, oh, this was changed because it was too predictable. Things were not often changed because they were predictable. Things were often changed, but, oh, it's too predictable was just one of the things on the laundry list that you could go with if you didn't like an idea. And if that's the one that stuck, great. But that wasn't a specific reason. That was just, oh, I don't like this idea, so, well, it's too predictable, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, Van Damme was supposed to win at Unforgiven. Didn't happen. Going into No Mercy, you know, we wanted Kane to be the first guy in history to unify the tag team, Intercontinental, and World Heavyweight Championships. Hmm. That was the plan. There was an agents meeting the morning of the WrestleMania 19 press conference. So Vince, Stephanie, and Triple H roll up in Seattle for the press conference. So I think Shane McMahon ran the meeting that day, and all the agents were there, and Shane or Brian or whoever it was brought up the idea, and the agents loved it. Oh, that's great. You know, Kane deserves it. That'll be terrific. That's a great thing. Nobody's ever done that before. And then by later in the afternoon when they all got back, it was suddenly, okay, well, you know, Triple H is going to, you know, go over now.
Wow.
Which goes to show you exactly, you know, it wasn't until Survivor Series when, you know, he loses to his buddy that he gets the title, you know. And even after I left, I mean, I heard, you know, Booker was supposed to at one point win the world title at Mania that year. And again, there's a lot of discussion. There's a lot of things thrown out there. Every scenario is on the table. I mean, you can hear of a pay-per-view match with a challenger that you don't think stands a chance. There's been a discussion among creative. Well, what if this happened? I mean, they talk about all this stuff, and rightfully so, because you got to flesh it out. But you could see the pattern there. You could see... I don't want to use the word insecurity because, again, I don't know what was going on. It was just my perception. But you could see how things were being crafted for the betterment of certain things at the expense of others.
Yeah.
If I can hedge that, read between the lines however you like.
Yes. Yep. Very good. Let's see. Jay, do you have any follow-up for us?
Yeah, I mean, that's good stuff. And I thought it would have made more sense for Triple H to hold that belt and then drop it to Van Damme and Mania, even if it meant Shawn going over at MSG so Rob could have that spot. Then when it never happened, I was like, what's up with that? But my final question is, was Triple H behind that main force behind wanting Austin to lose on TV to Brock Lesnar?
I have no idea. I have no idea. I was not on creative at the time, and I don't want to speak to them.
Yeah, we just don't know why, Jay.
Okay.
I can tell you, some people thought that. Some people thought that.
Right.
Yeah.
The funniest thing, by the way, the funniest thing just from the fallout of that is I was at TV the week after that happened interviewing guys for the story that I wrote for the magazine about Austin walking out. And I mean, I was interviewing Brock, and Brock was like, you know, and this is in the story. He says, you know, I don't understand it. He's like, you know what, give me $1 million and, you know, you won't see me crying or you won't see me unhappy. And it's like, well, 2 years from now you'll have a lot of millions of dollars and you'll be really unhappy. So,
yeah.
It's not about the money. It's not about the fame. It's not about any of that stuff. I mean, this world that these people live in is so unique and so all-consuming and potentially destructive that it takes a very specific type of personality to thrive and to survive there. You know, I love the wrestling business. I love it more than anything in the world. It's my favorite hobby. It's been my passion for 20-plus years. For the rest of my life, I was 23 years old, I had my dream job. I mean, how many people can say that?
Yeah.
But, I was one of the few who quit. I was on creative. I had a dream job. I was doing well. I was doing good ideas, working with people that I liked, but I just couldn't stay in that world. It takes a very specific type of personality to stay in to thrive there. And you know, I had great experience, but it's just...
I think it's one of the reasons that people who were in your position the last 10, 12 years all stay in touch. There's a certain camaraderie to having been through that and in that unique circumstance, whether it was a half a year or 2 years or Dave Lagana being there, you know, or a really long time, but not there anymore. There's a bond there that you only know if you were in that position and working in that weird cauldron and environment.
Jericho has a great, great way to describe it. And I think it's in one of his books. He says that it's like being in war. He's like, unless you were there, nobody else will ever understand it, and you never know who's gonna survive.
Yeah, and I hesitate. I think it's an apt analogy, but I feel a little bit. I think people who have been to war would say, well, come on. But I totally know what you
right.
mean, and I know what Jared...
Oh, no disrespect to veterans or any of that stuff,
yeah.
Of course.
But it is another example of people who, like, it's hard. We can have a good conversation, and the other creative team members, I can have a good conversation with them, but I've never been there, and I can interview them and get that. But it's sort of like when people come back from war, and it's like they're a stranger to their family, or their family can't really tap into why aren't you the way you were before you left? And that's the only place that somebody who's been through war and seen the horrors and lived through the boredom and the fear and all the extreme emotions that occurs there, it's someone else who's been through it.
Absolutely. I mean, I saw Lagana out in California about 2009. I hadn't seen it for probably 5-6 years before that. And we got together and, you know, an hour or 2 hours later and stuff, we're still telling war stories.
Yeah.
So you're exactly right.
Yeah.
Do you love Pro Wrestling Torch? Then we've got another show just for you, Ring Rust Radio.
Ring Rust Radio breaks down the hottest topics and news from around the wrestling world, including WWE Raw, SmackDown, and pay-per-views, TNA, Lucha Underground, New Japan, and indie wrestling. Edit in interviews with the biggest names in the industry, like Stone Cold Steve Austin, Shawn Michaels, Bret Hart, Paul Heyman, Kurt Angle, and many more. And Ring Rust Radio has something for everyone.
Check out the show on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Interact with us on Twitter at Ring Rust Radio and email us at ringrustradio@yahoo.com.
All right, let's go to our final caller of the show, and it is area code 847. Thanks for holding. Please state your name and where you're from.
This is Jason. How you guys doing?
Good. Where are you from, Jason?
I'm in Chicago, in the Chicago area.
How you doing, man?
Good.
I'm doing
good.
I got a question for Seth. Just wanted to say I'm out of work right now, and I'm on Twitter a lot, and by far right now you're hands down my favorite person on Twitter.
Thank you very much. That's very kind. Thank you.
Yeah, for sure.
If you like me, by the way, make sure you follow Lagana, because if it wasn't for David Lagana, I wouldn't be on Twitter.
You know what? He's actually the guy who I saw referred me to you in the first place. So, yeah, you guys are both
cool.
Awesome.
Thank you very much.
I think he invented it.
That's the rumor.
he invented and popularized it, yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. Seth, in 2002, The Road to Mania, I just something that's always kind of bug me that I wondered is why Nash was left off the Mania card and not put in an actual match. Just wanted to see if you knew anything about that.
Again, I wasn't on creative during the build to Mania 18. From what I heard, the first that we heard that the NWO were coming in were very, very, very shortly before they did. That might have very much been almost like a last-minute thing. I mean, the first time that we heard that they were going to go with Rock versus Hogan was probably about a week or two before they actually announced it and did it on TV. The first scenario that I had heard, and this information stems from, they used to do it at TV every week. They would do what they called, logically, the TV meeting, which is they would bring in people from around the company and just kind of go down some bullet points of lists just so everybody was on the same page in terms of branding and storylines and all that stuff. And the original plan that I heard, if memory serves, for Mania was for it to be Austin versus Nash, not Austin versus Hall, which was then changed. As I understand it, because of the turnaround in bringing them in, whatever, Nash just might not have been ready to work yet. You know, and I don't recall him working a lot during that first run with the NWO. I know they did that 3-on-2 match in the go home for Mania that year, but I think it was
right.
Just because Hall was in the best shape of them all.
Yeah,
was all I know. I don't know why Nash didn't work. at Mania that year. I honestly couldn't tell you. I'm sorry.
And you weren't booking at the time, but do you know if there was ever any thought of doing Stone Cold versus Hogan instead of Rock? Or
I think that from what I had heard, and I don't know how accurate this is, the Hogan match was pitched to Austin, who did not want to do it.
Wow.
Again, at the time, Austin was, I don't want to use the word paranoid, because again, I don't know him, I can't see into his psyche, but he was in a spot where, you know, Triple H was the featured guy, and he wasn't the guy that everybody was building around like the way he was just a few months earlier. And Hall and Nash, he at least had more of a common history with them, whereas Hogan was a complete and total wild card. And so, as I understand it, I think that the match with Hogan was pitched to Austin, who said he would rather not, and they went with Rock Hogan, and then Austin wound up being the fourth or fifth or sixth match from the top of the card.
Yeah.
Instead of the main event as he was supposed to be, or fighting Hogan as I understand it, was on the table as well.
Right. Wow. Okay. All right. Well, thank you guys. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. Thank you for calling.
Hey, how can people follow you on Twitter again, Seth?
It's just at Seth Mates, SethMates. Try to answer questions when I can, if I'm at the gym doing cardio or something like that. And you know, it's fun. It's fun. After I left wrestling, it took me years before I could truly enjoy it again.
Really?
The old metaphor, if you like sausage, don't ever watch sausage being made.
Yeah.
And then after that, it took a few years, and just as I was getting back into it is when the Benoit thing happened. And that was like, ugh. You know, now it's just kind of whatever. But you know, Lagana encouraged me to get on Twitter, and Twitter and interacting with the fans and everybody and talking about the shows has made me fall in love with it again. So,
interesting, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think a lot of people, I was talking about this last night with someone, that Twitter could, technology has caused people to not watch TV shows live. You know, DVR them, fast forward to commercials, watch it on, you know, watch what you want when you want to watch it. It's hurt the hour right before the evening news in terms of the dramas, because a lot of people tape the sitcoms and then watch them later on delay after their kids go to bed or mm-hmm. when they get in from dinner. And so I thought it's kind of ironic that Twitter may be the technology that slows that or reverses that, because Twitter has made watching television alone or in a small group more social, because you can keep track with hashtag and following your friends, what your friends are watching at that moment also. It makes
Absolutely.
Watching television live something that's more enjoyable, whether it's wrestling or anything, because you get to see what your friends and famous people and reviewers that you respect are saying about something as it airs, and you don't have to worry about spoilers.
Right, absolutely. Completely yeah. agree. I mean, I work most Mondays, but I always try and sneak away into a conference room and at least catch the opening segment and throw up some comments and whatever, because I want to see what's going on the show sometimes, just because it's fun to just be able to interact with it and see what other people are saying about it, too. So
yep.
You're absolutely right.
Well, thank all the callers. We're going to take a couple email questions here on the remaining minutes on the free part of the Peter Lee Torch livecast here. Then we'll do a few minutes of VIP after show for our members, who we appreciate so much. Speaking of which, the place to go to sign up for a VIP membership, if you're interested in going VIP and hearing the complete versions of all the interviews we do on Fridays, plus having access to 25 years worth of archives, including a new back issue put up in a PDF digital format every week from 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and 20 years ago. And we're also putting up some of the best content from those newsletters, from those back issues. We're putting some of the text versions of that up on a mobile-friendly page that we just added in the past couple of weeks. And one of the newest features we have for VIP members is now the VIP mobile grid. And if you click on the little picture of the iPhone icon in the upper right corner now of the VIP website, once you sign up, there's the main ad-free website to get all the VIP access, a little picture of an iPhone. And if you log into that on your smartphone, it takes you to a mobile-friendly VIP grid where you can gain access to the VIP message boards, the VIP blogs. These are VIP-exclusive short blogs written by the Torch staff on a daily basis. And also, one-click access to all of our VIP audio shows. We put up around 70 new audio shows that are VIP-exclusive every month, with a lot of the personalities you hear on the live cast every week, plus others, and including the daily Wade Keller Hotline, which I've done for going on almost 2 years straight now without missing a day. Every morning, there's a Wade Keller Hotline waiting for you with a review, analysis of the latest news, 10, 20, 30 minutes of analysis of the latest news, answering VIP member questions, reviewing the latest TV show. And the VIP grid also gives you access to, as I just said, some articles from the back issues in a mobile-friendly environment. So throughout the week, You can click on the VIP article button on the VIP mobile grid and get access to not just the latest newsletter articles, but also some of the great articles, including the article I referenced earlier in the live cast about the Torch staff rating on a 1 to 10, the top 10 stars of the WrestleMania years who had held the WWE versions of the world title during the WrestleMania years. That was one of the articles we put up from 10 years ago. Fascinating stuff in these 5, 10, and 20 years ago back issues that now many of the top articles are available on mobile phones where a lot of people are spending their time these days. So the place to go to sign up or just get more information on the pricing and the sign-up process is pwtorch.com/govip. pwtorch.com/govip. New newsletter each week, tons of back issues, 25 years worth of archives that will keep you busy, including a lot of interviews from over the years, both transcribed and audio. All right, Seth, let's go to a couple email questions here. And
do you have that written down, by the way, or is that all improvised? Because that's impressive.
I've been doing it for over 2 years, and it just it just comes out. It's different all the time, but it's not that different.
Congratulations on almost 25 years, by the way. I didn't even realize. Congratulations.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, it was October of 87. Was
wow.
The first edition of the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter was published. I was 16 years old, so I've been doing what I've been doing for 25 years, but I'm still sort of middle age, not old.
Very cool.
All right. Let's see. Oh, I got all these good email questions on board. I'll just grab one randomly here. This is from Muhammad, who says, "Hello, Seth. During your time as a WWE writer, what were the top pranks pulled by wrestlers that you witnessed or heard about?"
Oh my God. The best that I heard about, and again, my first few weeks that I was on creative, I was working out of Stanford still. But there was one week that they were out in Seattle. I think it was maybe it was the week after I joined. And Raw goes off the air, and Taker is in the ring, and all the boys start coming out, and they ribbed Undertaker, which never happened, into trying to get him to do a spin-a-rooney.
Yeah.
You know, to do a Taker-rooney. And like, literally, one by one, everybody's coming out. You know, obviously, you know, Booker's coming out. And then, you know, Triple H comes out. I think Vince came out and did, like, a Vince-a-rooney or something. They're trying to get him to break character. And you just see him. He keeps holding his hand up to his mouth, and he's holding back the smile, and it was the talk of the tower the next day. It was absolutely hilarious. I don't think it was ever released as an extra anywhere, unless I'm mistaken. But Taker was one of those guys that you just don't rip Taker. And I think it was Vince's idea or something like that. It was really, 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 really funny. That's the only one that I know of on a grand level.
Yeah.
That's the only one I could think of off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the punchline is that Taker never did the spin-a-rooney. He came up with some excuse to be able to beat up one of the heels and then left the ring and went backstage.
Muhammad has a second question. What were Jeff Hardy and CM Punk like during their feud?
Punk didn't start until after I had already left.
Yeah.
Jeff was going through a barrage of problems while I was there. You know, that was during the stretch when he was often late to shows. In fact, when Kane and the Hurricane won the tag team titles on Raw, I think it was the day after Unforgiven 2002, the original plan had been for it to be Kane and Jeff Hardy, but Jeff was becoming more irresponsible and you know, thankfully he seems to have, you know, be in a much better place now, thankfully, because he's a good dude. But at the time, he wasn't in a great spot, which is why we put Hurricane in that spot, and Hurricane did great, so.
Yeah, yeah. All right, Nolan from Long Island says, he doesn't mean this to be facetious, but it may seem so, because I'm not sure how to word it. Does Vince McMahon have any appreciation at all for good technical athletic style workers, or guys who can go, as they say, Daniel Bryan, Kurt Angle? And have you heard him comment on, or commend any wrestlers, I should say, for that exact trait, whether to them or to members of creative and staff? I guess another way to put it is, if Vince were to see a video of, say, Davey Richards from ROH, would he be able to recognize his clear technical prowess and skill, even if he doesn't fit his mold of wrestlers he'd like to hire in other ways and aspects? I absolutely recognize that not everyone on the roster can be smaller athletic guys and believe there's a place in wrestling for all shapes and sizes, as well as skill sets, but I would be disheartened to hear that the greatest wrestling promoter of all time, I guess arguably, could no longer appreciate a sound athletic match that was more simulated combat than it was, quote, sports entertainment, even if that style is not what he feels earns the most money and attracts the largest audience. Simply put, is there a good old-fashioned wrestling fan still inside of Vince McMahon? Hope that's clear. Thanks for answering my question, and thank you, Wade, for all you do with the Torch.
I don't quite know how to approach that. I mean, I've had the discussion with people. I don't know that there was ever a wrestling fan inside of Vince McMahon. Mm. I mean, he loves the glitz and the glamour and the flair and the showmanship and the and all that. And it, can he appreciate a good match if all that is behind it? Yes, but I don't. I don't know. I honestly couldn't tell you. I honestly couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't. I forget who I had this conversation with, and I'm not taking credit for this point, but I wish I could remember who had said this, but Vince's greatest inner struggle is that Vince is the king of wrestling, but Vince hates wrestling.
Yeah.
You know, Vince is the man in wrestling, but Vince, the reason why Vince hated Ted Turner so much is because Vince wanted to be Ted Turner.
I
Vince
know.
Vince wants to be the guy who built a media empire, not the guy who built a wrestling empire.
Yeah.
You know, that's why he's, you know, sitting on a gold mine and could be doing all this great stuff, and he's, you know, starting networks with, you know, cooking shows on it. You know what I mean?
What is Vince like behind the scenes watching on the monitor a good match take place?
I only sat in Gorilla one time. You know, back when I was first getting started, Stephanie wanted me to have a few different experiences. So I sat in the production truck one night. It was actually the night of HLA I sat in the production truck, if you remember that.
Mm-hmm.
But I only sat in Gorilla with Vince once. And the thing about during a wrestling show is you're never able to actually just sit back and enjoy and focus and really take it in. You know, there's always someone with a question. You're always producing the next thing that's going to happen. You're always making a suggestion. I saw him, you know, radio stuff to the referee, have him do this now, have him do that now, you know, like every once in a while. I think he has a genuine appreciation for wrestling, but I think that ultimately at the end of the day, he'd rather have a, you know, like a just a spectacular Hollywood moment.
Yeah,
and if the wrestling is the means to an end for that, then great.
And
you know,
I think
that this is my speculation. It's not like I ever had the conversation and he said, "Oh, I hate wrestling."
And I think Stephanie McMahon was cursed, and Shane were cursed with this too, as Vince was. They didn't naturally gravitate to professional wrestling when flipping channels in their parents' house when they were 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 years old, like most people. You know, somewhere in that age group, most people become fans. You know, probably 9 to 15 years old is the average. There's the range where 90% of fans first started watching, no matter what age they are today. And they grew up in it. You know, Vince never decided to be a fan. Stephanie never decided to be a fan. Vince, Stephanie, Shane never were talked into buying a wrestling ticket. They don't have that experience. And I think it's a valuable experience. It doesn't mean you have to have it to be successful, but I think it's a drawback to your ability to relate to fans. And for Vince, he never had a chance to sit back and be a wrestling fan. And that might... He had great advantages being the son of Vince Sr. and being brought into it and having a mind for it and clearly successful on the business side of it. And he has a vision for a different version of pro wrestling than what a lot of people were promoting. But he never did get to just sit down and be a fan at a show. And I wonder how much he would, if Vince were born into a different family, but it was the exact same person otherwise, you know, would he have become a guy who would, for fun, watch wrestling? And I don't know the answer to that. I think he enjoys the challenge of being a promoter and negotiating the egos and obviously telling stories and plotting out feuds. But I think that wrestling just happens to be the way that what he is good at and enjoys doing resolves itself as a product. Is that a fair way to put it?
I think you're absolutely at the nail on the head. I think you're absolutely 100% right.
Yeah.
And going to another point you made, which is interesting, we used to have this conversation in the writer's room very frequently about how we would believe in putting, you know, this person, featuring this person on TV, doing this storyline, et cetera. And there would be voices from the agent's room, you know, or some of the boys would speak against that. And it's like, well, all right, on one hand, you have this group of people who haven't paid for wrestling in God knows how long, and who's how much money they're going to make and how far they're going to go in the business is specifically tied to what's happening on that television, versus a team of people whose only job there is to make the company money and who have paid for wrestling recently and who are just saying, this is what I would want to see.
Yeah.
And that balancing act could get very, very frustrating at times because, you know, it's nice to say, oh, you know, it's a team environment and everybody wants everybody to succeed. Everybody wants as big a piece of the pie as possible. That's the bottom line. And whether the fans get the best product or not is not always number one on the agenda and in the decision-making process. And you want your talent to be happy, but there's a very, very, very fine line there. Going to the Vince thing, I think you're absolutely right. And I think you went into it, and I think it's more the power and the control and the ambition for the to be a big entertainment figure, and wrestling was just a means to an end. I think that's his ultimate inner curse, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. No, I think you're right that he wanted to be something more, and I think that's one of the reasons he got a little obsessed with Ted Turner at one point. I mean, you know, that. I mean, he wanted to be the guy who did more than just wrestling. I mean, I've told the story before on the show, but Vince McMahon called me up one time during the heat of the Monday Night War, and I wasn't even sure why, but he drew a picture for me, which is how, like, essentially what he wanted me to do is report more how crazy Ted Turner was. And he said, I've got all these clippings on my desk of all these stupid, crazy, insane things Ted Turner has said. And it was like, listen to this. He once said this in 1979. He said this just last month. And I've got this clip of this interview, and he said this. This guy's crazy. And it was just like, it was this weird thing, but he was going through a time where not only was Ted more successful at wrestling than he was at that moment in time, and Vince was reeling from it and trying to figure out how to recover, but Ted was also where Vince wanted to get to. And I think we saw that with so many different things that Vince has tried to do. Over the years, XFL being one of the primary examples. And how does the XFL? You were in WWE during that run, but not on creative. But did you get a sense of how that took Vince's attention away from things?
Within the company, you could clearly see that resources that should have been, because that the business was at its absolute hottest in early 2001. I mean, they were printing money at that point.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, the day that I started, I started there full-time May 30th, 2000. And the day that I started, there was, I think, 10 new employees who started that day. I think there was two for WWF and 8 or 9 for the XFL.
Yeah.
It might have been a slightly different balance than that, but I don't remember. But you could see that, here you had these employees who were already worked.
All right, so that'll do it for this special PW Torch Livecast Interview Thursday from the Vault. Hope you enjoyed that hour and a half plus with former WWE creative team member Seth Mates from the early 2000s, a transition from the Attitude Era to the John Cena era chronicled there with some great behind-the-scenes insights. The last 53 minutes of this marathon interview I did with Seth 5 years ago is going to be posted later for VIP members. So if you're not a VIP member and you want to hear the rest of this, go VIP. It's a great opportunity to find out what it is that's on the other side of that VIP wall that you're missing out on. And you can find out full details at pwtorch.com/govip. Find out why our members swear by our service, all the benefits they get, the ad-free and plug-free editions of this live cast, along with exclusive shows that are VIP only. And there's over a dozen of them per week. It's about 50 per month that are VIP exclusive podcasts in addition to the live cast. And yes, they're all available on popular podcast apps on iPhone and Android and iTunes, or you can stream them right from our desktop friendly and mobile friendly PW Torch VIP website. So check out details, pwtorch.com/govip. Tonight, Mike and Andrew take over right after Impact goes off the air on Pop TV, so join them live for the live cast post-Impact edition, and then tomorrow, Bruce and Rich do Primetime Friday at 7 Eastern. Thanks, everybody. Until next time, Wade Keller, signing off. This is live.